It's Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And on the show today, coming up in the later portion, we're going to have countertenor Jay Carter, who's appearing with the Baroque Artist of Champaign-Urbana Sunday evening in Champaign. And for the first portion, we'll have members of the Danville Light Opera production of the musical Hello, Dolly, which is going to take place not this coming weekend, but the following in Danville. And hope you will enjoy today's show. From Hello, Dolly, the original Broadway production. And that was the introduction to the show. It's going to be happening in a production by the Danville Light Opera the following next weekend, not this coming. And we have with us the director of the production, Tom Fricke, and also two of the members of the cast, Becky Burgoyne. And you're in which role?
I'm Dolly Levi.
You are Dolly Levi, okay. And I came in without my notes, and I'm doing one of these old person things because I know who's sitting exactly across from me, but...
It's Michelle Barr.
Michelle Barr. Thank you very much, Michelle. Sorry about that. And your role is?
I'm Irene Malloy.
Okay. So, you know, I've never seen Hello, Dolly, I'm sorry to say, and I really don't know what the story is. So who wants to take that on and tell us the story, for assuming there's others like me out there?
The story of Hello, Dolly is the Broadway play is based on the Thornton Wilder's book, The Matchmaker. It's basically Dolly Levi is a meddlesome matchmaker and is an expert at most things and craftsman of none. So she is constantly arranging things for people, as the first song of the production indicates, that she's always had a habit of arranging things, and the best things she arranges is matrimony and love. And so throughout the entire production, Dolly is matchmaking people together. She's on a quest to find Horace Vandergelder, who is one of Yonkers' preeminent citizens, is in search of a new mate, and so she is diligently trying to matchmake him with various people along the way, one of which is Irene Malloy. And so Horace's head clerk, Cornelius Hackle, decides that it's time for him to find love as well, and so Dolly ends up helping him out along the way. And Ermengarde, who is Horace's niece, is wanting to marry someone that Horace doesn't think is quite right for her, and so he has engaged Dolly to help find Ermengarde a suitable mate, and all sorts of antics ensue therein.
And I'm guessing that some of her helping turns out to be maybe not so helpful.
Well, it's helpful. It just doesn't necessarily start out the way it doesn't end up the way it started out. And people get helped and people get matched, but the matchmaking ends up taking some different twists along the way. And Dolly's matching herself up along the way as well.
So, Becky, in the role of Dolly, you've got this woman who played the role over and over and over and over again, who is somehow probably difficult to detach from the role of Dolly Levi in the case of Carol Channing. Is that easy for you to do?
Well, it's a great role model to have because I have someone to watch the type, what Dolly Levi should be. And you think of Carol Channing or even Barbara Streisand from the movie version of Hello, Dolly. So those are two phenomenal actresses to look at. And I have been told by someone to just play her as an outrageous flirt that is very charming, and you couldn't deny Dolly anything. So it's an honor to play this role. Ever since I was a little girl, I always wanted to be on stage in a lead. And you think of the Carol Channings, the Barbara Streisands, the Hello Dolly, MAME, all those incredible musical shows. And to finally find myself in this role, it's a marvelous challenge. It's a ton of fun.
Well, as I said, I've not seen it. I've seen Carol Channing probably do bits from the show on television, and much of it when she was long past her prime, I'm sure. But I've always kind of wondered how. I mean, she never struck me as a singer, really. You know, she's somebody that.
She lets me off the hook just a little bit.
Well, just somebody that you caricature.
Right.
She's so easy to caricature, and I'm assuming you're not even going to attempt anything like that.
No, I won't sing that low into the basement. No.
No. That's one of the interesting things with this production is that the materials we received from the publisher was written in Carol Channing's original key, and it is very low for most singers. And fortunately for Becky and for the production, that the publisher realized it was not a singable key for a lot of performers, so a lot of Dolly's songs have been rewritten so that they are a little more singable.
And so how does that work for you, Becky?
It works just fine. I'm lucky to have a large vocal range and can sing low and can sing high. So it fits great.
Who's the music director for this production?
Karen Grove is the music director for this. Karen is the music teacher at Oakwood Elementary School. Karen's done several DLO productions, and so she is guiding us through the music. And then choreographing is Sherry Turner. And Sherry's been involved with DLO shows in the past, and this is actually her first time as a choreographer for a show, but came highly recommended by past choreographers and has done a great job.
Yes.
I just wondered if there were any of the songs that somebody needed to do some additional transposition. And for those who don't know, transposition means that, you know, you take it from one key, say the key of C, and turn it into something else, presumably higher in this case, or pretty much everything you've got. There's enough to work with from what you were sent from the publisher.
Yes, the publisher. The problem with trying to transpose a song that you get from the publisher is that you've got to change not only the vocal score and the piano score, but then you have to change all the orchestration instruments that are in various keys as well. So it can be a very daunting task if you try to transpose a song on your own. So we're very fortunate that Tams Whitmark, who is the publisher of this production of Hello Dolly, has that transposition available.
For once, they thought ahead. So many of the publishers
yes.
don't. Michelle, I know you know about that because you've done music direction for some shows and stage direction
yes,
for
have.
Some shows for Champaign-Urbana Theater Company. How do you enjoy going back and forth between being on stage and being in a directing role?
Well, last year I primarily and only did production roles. I music directed and directed and did the orchestra pit, and it's very refreshing to be back on stage and very relaxing to let go of some of those responsibilities that go with having a leadership role. So I'm having a lot of fun right now.
Gee, I would think that being on stage would be far less relaxing, but that's that's just me. I like being in the director's seat. I don't think I could manage the other somehow or another. So tell me about Irene Malloy.
My character, I am a widowed hat maker, a millineress, and I'm just about to break out of New York. I'm ready to have some fun, to have a bit of adventure, and that's I sing a song about wearing this beautifully gaudy hat with ribbons all the way down my back, and how this will attract a man, and how I will start dating again. And, of course, this is where Dolly comes in, and this is the same day where Mr. Horace Vandergelder is coming to meet me, and he is my new beau, but only for about 5 minutes in the show.
Yes.
Yes.
Because things go tragically wrong.
Yes, things go awry.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
So that's kind of the lead up to this particular song, Ribbons Down My Back.
It is. Yeah.
Do you know offhand who's singing it in this production? This, again, Tom, I think is the Broadway production.
I have that from the original Broadway production. Eileen Brennan.
Eileen
was
Brennan.
Irene Malloy.
I've heard of her.
Yes.
And so here we go. Put Ribbons Down My Back from Hello Dolly on Live and Local.
I'll be wearing ribbons down my back,
Ribbons Down My Back, sung by the character of Irene Molloy, in this case Irene Brennan, from, is it Eileen Brennan? Irene Molloy, Eileen Brennan. And Irene will be sung by Michelle Barr in the Danville Light Opera's production that is going to happen next weekend. And this is Live and Local on FM 90.9. We've got Michelle with us and also Becky Burgoyne in the role of Dolly. Those shows are going to be Saturday and Sunday, the 23rd and 24th at Danville High School Auditorium. Also with us, the director of the production, Tom Fricke. Danville Light Opera, I assume from the name of it, does everything musical. You don't do any straight plays, or do you sometimes?
No, we don't. Danville Light Opera started in 1956 as a musical production company. Danville is very fortunate to be blessed with several strong artistic production groups. Red Mask Players does plays, and then Danville Light Opera comes along and fills the musical production side of artistic productions in Danville. And so, as I said, we've been doing that since 1956. We're in our 57th season this year, and or 56th season. I counted that up this morning. The years and the season numbers don't match up because our season split over the new year. But Hello, Dolly, this is our second time of performing Hello, Dolly. It was first performed in 1971. And the man we have playing Horace Vandergelder in this production, Ron McDaniel, actually played Cornelius Hackle in the 71 production. So I guess he's been promoted from chief clerk to store owner.
So he's been involved for a while. Well, that's over 30 years. It's about time you did it again.
Yes, yes. There, several of those great stage musicals of the 70s and 60s were done by DLO. Some have been repeated, some haven't, and it had long been a dream of mine to see some of those musicals come back. And so I, with the support of my wife Mary Ellen, we put into direct Hello Dolly this time. And so it's great to have it on the DLO schedule this year.
Becky, you said that this is a role that you have looked forward to, the possibility of doing sometime. Is this your first time doing it?
This is my first time to do Dolly Levi in Hello, Dolly, yes.
And what do you think is appealing both about the character and the show that has lasted so long?
Oh, it's a classic, a boy meets girl, and the true love and the fun, the frivolity of it. And then also just a bit of melancholy on Dolly Levi's part, because she's been a widow for many years, and she often speaks throughout the show to her late husband, Ephraim Levi, who must have been a very wise person from what he has to say. And so there's a monologue where she says, "Let me go, Ephraim. It's time that I get on with my life." And therefore, you see the little bit of the vulnerability of Dolly Levi, but then you see her determination and the fun that comes along the way for her to land Horace Vandergelder so she can take his millions or his half a millions, as she's
at least
60,000 in cash, and spread it around like manure, helping young things to grow. So
that sounds really nice.
Ride. Yes.
Interesting analogies that we have going on in songs here. We've got another tune, the Motherhood March. How does that fit into the show?
Well, this is after our last song, Ribbons Down My Back. Two young men enter the hat shop, and this is Cornelius Hackle and his friend Barnaby, and they actually are clerks in Mr. Vandergelder's shop. And, of course, Mr. Vandergelder is on his way to see me, and it would not do for two young men to be seen there. So,
especially since they weren't given the afternoon off.
Exactly.
Which is the more important faux pas here.
Yes.
So this song was actually not in the movie, so I was quite excited to see it because I had only seen the movie when I had gotten this role. It's called The Motherhood March, and Dolly is trying to distract Horace from the fact that there's two men trying to hide in various places around the hat shop.
From Hello, Dolly, here on Live and Local.
I stand for motherhood, America, and a hot lunch for orphans. Take off your hat, sir. Betsy Ross's flag is passing. Do you see him? March, march!
To form a more perfect union.
March, march! Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. March, march, march!
And the inimitable, inimitable, Carol Channing in the role of Dolly Levi with, what were the other characters in that song?
Irene Malloy, played by Eileen Brennan.
Yep.
And
Minnie Faye, who was played by Sondra Lee.
All right. And that was the Motherhood March. And Danville Light Opera is putting on Hello, Dolly! On the 23rd and 24th at the Danville High School Auditorium. And if you'd like more information, it's danvillelightopera.com. Easy enough. Mm-hmm. Support for our show today here on FM 90.9 comes from Sangamon Auditorium, University of Illinois, Springfield, presenting David Sedaris Friday, October 22nd at 8 p.m. Humorist David Sedaris is the author of many books and plays, including Holidays on Ice, Me Talk Pretty One Day, and his latest, Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, a modest Bestiary. Ticket information is at sangamonauditorium.org. And we have support from Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from noon to 4 in the Bouvon's Tasting Room. More information is at thecorkscrew.com. So, I mean, the show has been around for so long that I assume it's not really giving the show away to ask, does Dolly get her man?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, that's what makes it
that's a
comedy and not a tragedy, right?
That's correct. Correct. Dolly wins in the end, yes.
Yeah. At the time Dolly was on Broadway, it became the longest-running production at that time and is still in the top 10 list, or I think 10, maybe slightly under top 10, but it's still one of the higher-ranking productions in terms of consecutive performances.
Why do you think it took Danville Light Opera 30 plus years to get it back on the stage?
Well, just as with Broadway, there are so many other good productions out there, and the fact that we're only able to do three a year, probably just as other people developed other types of musicals, they went with some of those and decided it was time to bring back one of the old classics again.
And what are your other shows this year?
Our other shows for this season is our dinner theater in February is A, My Name is Alice. And then coming up in May, stage musical version of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Well, no, that's a nice variety, I would think.
A little bit of something for everyone. Classic, music review, and a new production.
And how does somebody get tickets to see Hello, Dolly?
Tickets are available through our box office. You can call and reserve tickets, 217-431-1660, and use your credit card to reserve tickets. You can also stop by our box office in the Village Mall Shopping Center in Danville Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4, and next week, Monday through Wednesday, from 6 to 8 p.m., if you're in Danville during the day, tickets are also available at First Savings Bank at 6 West William Street in Danville. And then tickets will be available at the door as well. Danville High School Auditorium has plenty of seating, so there's not a fear of running out of tickets. It's just a matter of you want to get good, better seats or aisle seats. Probably a good idea to call and reserve them ahead of time.
Okay, and if you'd like more information, of which there is a great deal about the rather historic Danville Light Opera, you can go to danvillelightopera.com. And Tom Fricke is the director of their production of Hello, Dolly. Becky Burgoyne in the title role of Dolly Levi, and Michelle Barr is Irene Malloy. Thank you all very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
And here's Mary Martin in the title song from the London production on Live and Local.
And all
It's almost strange not to hear Carol Channing in that, but gotta say, Mary Martin sounds just a little bit better. The title song from Hello, Dolly. And again, you can see Danville Light Opera's production on the 23rd and 24th of October, 7:30 on Saturday the 23rd, 2 o'clock on Sunday the 24th. For more information, danvillelightopera.com. You can help us expand the community of WYL contributors. Our fall pledge drive kicks off with a power hour this Wednesday. Is it this Wednesday? Next Wednesday, the 20th. Your gift now to the Member Match Fund will encourage others to follow your lead and help keep the pledge drive short. Send your check to WYL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org. On this portion of Live and Local, my guest is Jay Carter. He is a countertenor, and he's going to be performing with for the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock in Champaign, a recital of music for voice and lute that also features lutenist Jeffrey Noonan, and I think maybe some other performers on that as well. It's going to be at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine on South Wright Street in Champaign. Jay Carter is on the phone with me. In Kansas City, is that where William Jewell College is?
That's correct. I'm actually in Liberty, Missouri, which is a little town just north of Kansas City, about 15 miles. William Jewell's our claim to fame, as is the fact that Jesse James robbed his first bank just down the street. That's what Liberty seems to be known for.
Oh, well, how about that? I know who Jesse James was, but I didn't know his own personal history.
Yeah, he's got an affiliation here. It's a rich historical community.
Well, and you've got a rich affiliation there of sorts. Your undergrad degree is from William Jewell?
That's correct. I came here from Southern Illinois to work at William Jewell College as a student, and did that and stayed around for a few more years afterward before I left to go to graduate school in the East, and never thought I'd get to come back here and teach again. I've had that opportunity and have been here now for almost 3 years.
Tell me about William Jewell College. What makes that special?
It's a wonderful, small, coeducational, private liberal arts college. It's about 1,200 students. The music department is small, but very good. We have lots of interaction with our students, and as is kind of typical of the liberal arts model, not all of our students are music majors by any stretch. In fact, most of our students come from other disciplines on campus. So there's a rich sharing between the music department, the theater department, as well as people from the hard sciences, biology, pre-med, astronomy, all these things just kind of get lumped together, and we get to work and play with each other. It's wonderful.
I somehow would have expected that a countertenor, as a fairly unusual voice, would more likely be teaching in a conservatory that has an early music program.
Well, one of the things we're really interested in here at William Jewell is how good this early music is for young voices. They sing it well and are able to access the music to some level almost immediately, and it's proving to be a good teaching medium for young students especially. The chance to come back to my beloved alma mater and have a hand in helping push us toward that kind of work and becoming a very unique place at the same time is something very important to me, and I'm very thrilled by that.
Talk a little bit, for those who aren't really familiar with it, about the countertenor voice itself. What is it?
Well, that's a question that people often argue about. For me, my voice is essentially a falsetto male voice, where I use what singing teachers would call chest voice on the bottom to some extent. There are a lot of different ways to accomplish that sound. There are people who just use falsetto voice for all the way through. There are other people who, for whatever reasons, have exceptionally high male voices, like high tenors. And some of this repertoire falls very easily within their vocal register as well. The thing that this often gets confused with are the infamous castrati that came out of Italy in the 17th century, who were surgically altered to preserve their high voices. That's quite simply not the case with most countertenors. In fact, the castrati is a voice type more or less died out at the beginning of the 20th century.
Oh, I hope so.
And I always try to make a distinction there because people in lectures and things like that, they've always heard about the castrati. I mean, they may not have heard of a countertenor before, but they always have questions, and I usually try to cut to the chase pretty quickly on that. So
there are some countertenors who sing falsetto and some who just do that naturally.
Yeah, there's a whole French school of I guess I would say countertenoring, haute contre singers, and they're generally tenors with exceptionally high voices. That being said, haute contres generally don't sing repertoire written for anybody except for French Baroque composers, and to some extent, people influenced by them, like Henri Purcell. You almost will never see an haute contre singing the alto parts in a Handel oratorio or in a Bach cantata. There are occasional exceptions to that rule, but generally you don't see that happening. And they often distance themselves from the countertenor label, with some very small exceptions.
Does the countertenor generally sing in the alto range or the soprano range or some combination of the two?
Usually it's the alto range. Just the term countertenor itself comes from old markings in medieval and pre-medieval manuscripts where they had to label what the parts were. And the long part, or at one point the melody, was called the tenor part. It's from the Latin tenere, to be held. And it was usually long notes around which other things were improvised, a bit like a jazz solo would be. But they had to call these other parts something that were next to the tenor part. And the term that you see is contratenor, bassus, or the part next to the tenor but below, and contratenor altus, the part above. When I was younger and didn't know any better, I was always surprised that altos were called altos because that means high in Italian. And in my way of thinking, the altos that I had always heard never sang high at all. Well, then I realized that was a masculine label, and they are singing indeed very high if they're men, or exceptionally low if they're women. So there's you kind of have to figure out the semantics there, but the term comes from that.
And speaking of figuring things out, when did you figure out that you could sing countertenor?
It's a very strange story. I was an undergraduate here at William Jewell College, a freshman, a few weeks into school from a small town in southeastern Illinois. And one of the upperclassmen came to me and asked if I wanted to sing with a small chamber ensemble, a small chamber chorus. And I was young and very eager for acceptance and immediately said yes without finding out what I was committing myself to. And he put the music in my music mailbox, and I got it out the next day and started looking at it. And he had marked very carefully all the alto parts in the pieces. And I took it to him later in the day. I said, I'm a tenor. I don't know that I can do this. And he said, why don't you just show up for the first rehearsal and see how it goes, and then we'll talk once the rehearsal is over. And so I showed up next at the first rehearsal and sat there, and we began. And what I found was not only did I love the music, but that the parts, they lay in a particular spot in my voice that worked very well. And these were pieces by Elizabethan composers like William Byrd and Thomas Tallis, but also later composers like Henri Purcell and people that are certainly not English, some French composers as well as some German music by Heinrich Schütz and Dietrich Buxtehude. And I found out that this alto thing really seemed to be working, and I had a long talk with my teacher about it, and we started doing one extra lesson per week. So I would do one voice lesson as a tenor, and then one voice lesson as an alto, and I would flip-flop back and forth, and ultimately at some point I had to make a choice about what I was going to do, and that was a difficult process. Ultimately, I chose singing the countertenor voice because I loved the music so much, and my tenor voice was a bit of a workaday voice anyway. And this was a chance to do something very unique and unusual and something that I didn't really see anybody else doing near to me. As time has gone by, we're seeing countertenors more and more as a rule. It's still somewhat, well, it's still very unique, I guess I would say, but it's not unheard of as it was 30 or 40 years ago. And the good news is there's lots of music written for countertenor duets, and now there are occasionally chances to actually sing them. You might actually have two people in the same room at the same time that sing this voice part.
Well, why has it been relatively rare, and why has it become a little less so?
It seems to me that this voice type really began to die out in about the 1770s and the 1780s. There are a couple of different factors involved. Countertenors were at times a replacement for Italian castrati in Italian opera. And as Italian opera became less popular outside of Italy, that is to say Northern Europe, England, France, Germany, they began to write in their own more native styles. Instead of an Italian opera, you would have a show in English instead. And anything that had a connection with Italian opera seemed unfashionable at that point. So this notion of men singing in the high parts of their voice, portraying heroic characters, it just seemed out of place. Also, we certainly weren't beyond sexism in the 1770s, but we were beginning to see women appear upon the stage more and more frequently. It still was creating a scandal at times. But what we find is that women are certainly able to sing these alto parts very beautifully, and in some cases much more convincingly than your run-of-the-mill countertenor. And as a result, the voice type kind of fell out of fashion very quickly. And within 50 or 100 years, the only place we're finding countertenors is singing in cathedral choirs, where there's still an edict against women singing. In a way, it is something of a tradition built upon sexism to some extent, and that's something I try to talk very frankly about. And now that I am married to a mezzo-soprano, I feel like I can speak with some authority there and not seem too hypocritical. We have a lot of joking back and forth about it. Some playful word jabs from time to time.
Do you ever sing duets with your wife?
We do, and when I do, she makes me sing tenor.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Now, why is that?
Yeah,
professional jealousy?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think it's just it feels more natural for us to do that. She always jokes that when we began dating, I was still a tenor at that point, and she calls it bait and switch. You know, we get married, and then I change my voice type to something else.
So you've been married quite a while then?
We've been married 12 years. It's very wonderful. It's flown right by to the point that this whole countertenor singing thing, in a way, still feels very new. And I still remember, you know, the initial learning how the voice worked kind of thing, and it doesn't seem like an old, comfortable thing yet. It still feels very new and very fresh, and I always have to work my way through pieces the first time, and I'm always reminded of what a difficult process that really is.
Maybe we'll talk about that in a moment. I want to have our listeners hear you. You were able to send us a clip of one of the tunes that you're going to be singing on Sunday. Listeners, we're talking to countertenor Jay Carter, who is going to be appearing with lutenist Jeffrey Noonan Sunday evening at 7:30 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine on South Wright Street in Champaign. It's a presentation of the Baroque artists of Champaign-Urbana. And among the composers represented, Henry Purcell, John Dowland, is it Campion? I'm forgetting his first name.
Thomas Campion.
Thomas Campion.
Mm-hmm.
And who have we got that we're going to hear now?
Well, this is a piece by Henry Purcell called Music for a While. It's probably his one of his most famous pieces. It was originally written as auxiliary theater music for a show about Oedipus, a tragic story. And this has become, like so many of these restoration pieces, it's the one hit from the show that everybody kind of knows, if they know anything from the show at all. This particular recording is taken from a live performance, actually, at Yale University, and what you'll hear here is harpsichord and viola da gamba. For the performance on Sunday, we'll actually just be using theorbo, or bass lute, for this. So it's one of these wonderful pieces that is made to work with whatever instruments are available.
Jay Carter singing Henry Purcell's Music for a While on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I always love that title, Music for a While.
Yeah, it's a wonderful text. The whole point of the piece is essentially that music can get everything to stand still for a while and just hold things in their place while things move on a little bit around you, and then you kind of pick up and start again.
How well do you know lutenist Jeffrey Noonan?
Jeff and I have known each other for, I suppose, probably close to 8 years. I first ran across him. It was a very unusual situation. I was talking to someone from St. Louis, lamenting the fact that I had worked on these pieces by people like John Dowland, but had never gotten to perform these pieces with lute, which is certainly, in the case of Dowland, his original intent and the way they're most generally done. And the person I was talking to was from St. Louis, and they said, "Well, we have a wonderful lutenist here, actually, in St. Louis." And I found out how to get a hold of him. and within a few days had gotten a hold of him on the phone and had set up a time to get together and just, I guess I would call it a jam session, for lack of better terms. And we just got together and began working, and we got along very well, kind of from the very beginning, and immediately started talking about doing some recital work together. And we began doing programs and did a number throughout Illinois and throughout Missouri, and a number of collaborations in St. Louis with other Baroque organizations. And as I left for graduate school, we stopped doing those, and we are just now getting to the point where we have enough time in our lives and schedules to be able to do this kind of work again. And I'm very excited to be collaborating with Jeff again. He's a wonderful player and an incredibly versatile musician. In this concert, he will play not only theorbo, which is this giant giraffe-necked lute-looking thing, but he'll also play the lute, which looks like the theorbo's had its, you know, farther third chopped off. He'll also play, I believe, a few pieces on a little Baroque guitar. And I don't think we're doing anything with archlute or chitarrone, but he plays various and sundry fretted instruments and is wonderful at all of them.
It's Jay Carter we're talking with on Live and Local, and he'll be with Jeff Noonan on Sunday evening at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine for the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. That concert will start at 7:30. You mentioned right before playing this music before we heard you in this music by Purcell, needing to sort of discover the learning process, I guess, or work each new piece into your voice. What is that process like if you are a natural tenor, but obviously you sing countertenor with such incredible relaxation that it seems like it's just seamless?
The process for learning a new piece, it really has a lot to do with who the composer is. You have to get inside of how the composer works. And as time goes by, you begin to assimilate an arsenal of people that you say, I know I can do this work if it's by X. Handel is one of those composers for me. Almost everything in the oratorios and in the operas that is written for the alto voice fits very well. Bach is a completely different story, and I actually have to really agonize about Bach, especially the first time I learn a cantata or a new piece. I think part of the reason why that's so difficult with Bach is that he sometimes used falsettists like me, countertenors. At other times, he actually used boy altos that were older boys whose voices were starting to slide down but hadn't completely gone through puberty and changed. And Bach, we know, occasionally even got in trouble for trying to use females in the various choirs, whether at the church or for the town municipalities. In fact, he was fined on multiple occasions for this. So sometimes Bach's parts are, in a way, written for a different instrument than I am. That doesn't mean I can't make it work, and in some cases it works in spite of that. But there are certainly pieces that play so strongly to the specific characteristics of those other voices that I won't take them on. Every now and then a cantata will come along. Certainly the mainstream Bach rep, the St. Matthew Passion, the St. John Passion, and the kind of top 20 cantatas are all things that I've done and I've worked out. Those other pieces, though, they kind of have to be built from the ground up, and you start working your way through, and it is a bit like learning to drive an off-road course in a manual transmission vehicle. You have to be looking ahead to see where the vocal line is going and where you need to be and what gear you need to be in order to make it happen. And as a result, you sometimes make a number of crass errors along the way, which is why you spend time rehearsing, I suppose.
So when something doesn't work, what happens?
Usually it's the result of an inappropriate choice. I've chosen to flip too far into chest voice or too early into falsetto, and the way I notice it is that the rhetoric of the piece doesn't work, the text doesn't work, or something that's unimportant becomes stressed, or something that is important doesn't get enough stress. I always try to really work with the words. Most composers are trying to set words in a particular way, and they have something they're trying to say through those words. And if you can if you can bring that out, if you can bring the rhetoric of the piece out, I think in a way that is that's the primary goal that you have to serve, and then everything else on top of it is just icing on the cake.
This may be difficult to do on the phone or impromptu, for that matter. But are you able to do any kind of a demonstration of what doesn't work?
Oh, I certainly am capable of doing that. I don't know that I would want to do it publicly. The closest thing I can think of that would give your listeners an idea of that would just be to go on YouTube and just plug in the term countertenor and just do some listening and see what they hear. It's a very unforgiving instrument. It's a bit like playing bagpipe or beginning violin. Wrong notes are very wrong, and you'll hear everything from yodels to a voice that just doesn't quite sound in the low part of the voice, and it's a mixture of everything. Also, if they didn't want to go to do that, they could just think about the Bee Gees, and you know, there are times when that falsetto sound is very strident on top, and there are times where it's there but it's almost imperceptible. You can't quite tell. I always try to find references that people will know without being, you know, musicologists, that they can relate to. Certainly for my family, growing up where I did, tenors singing in Southern gospel music were the closest thing to a countertenor that I had ever heard. And there are a lot of similarities there. But sometimes the voice, if you've not thought about what you're going to do, the voice will just crack. Or will flip in an unexpected spot, and it often to a comic effect. In fact, we see composers doing that in opera, even to the contemporary times. They'll put a piece in a contemporary opera every now and then where maybe the bass soloist is making fun of a female soloist, and they'll sing a few lines in that falsetto register, and it's usually a pretty good comic effect, I found.
I've always been amazed at a lot of rock singers, that male rock singers, who sing so high,
yeah,
that even for a tenor, I don't know how they do it, and there seem to be so many of them that do it, and I wonder if the countertenor maybe isn't a lot more common than we think.
I think you may be onto something there. Certainly, the notes that we're hearing contemporary pop artists, I'm thinking of people like Justin Timberlake, very specifically, I'm convinced that a lot of what we're hearing is countertenoring. And what they're doing is they're manipulating the resonance of the voice to make it so far forward sounding. This is getting very pedagogical, but so that the sound really has a lot of resonance to it, and you almost don't realize that they're using a falsetto at all. It is the exact same thing that I'm doing when I get up around the G above middle C. I'm mixing the tone and placing it very far forward so that you're not distracted by the fact that it's a falsetto sound.
So have you ever been tempted to put any Journey songs on your recitals?
Not yet. Although I've done some pretty non-traditional things over the years, especially as recital enders. I just finished a program here in Kansas City a month and a half ago, and ended with a set of songs by an English songwriting duo named Flanders and Swan, who were very prominent in the 50s and 60s. They were very conservative-looking tuxedoed gentleman that proceeded to sing songs that were actually very politically forward-looking and very funny, and lots of double entendre humor that, you know, the Victorians certainly wouldn't have approved of.
I wrote this down as the only question I knew I wanted to ask you when I knew I was going to have this conversation, and that is, have you ever sung any PDQ Bach roles for bargain countertenor?
All of those pieces by Peter Schickele they are very near and dear to the countertenor heart. And one of the reasons why is because Schickele makes particular use of the parts of a countertenor voice that don't work particularly well. He knows where all the chinks in the armor are, and he's purposefully writing them there to again for comic effect. The man who he wrote a lot of these things for lived in Connecticut for a long time, and I've actually met people who knew him. I never met him, and in fact I think he's dead at this point. But people who knew him, and apparently he was one of the most wonderfully well-trained musicians, and for him to in a way condescend to purposefully sing poorly was more more of a challenge for him than singing well. And he made a lot of other recordings, and they're very beautiful. But he's really quite the musician to be able to make this bargain countertenor sound work. That being said, I've actually never performed any of the PDQ Bach Rep, but something that musicians tend to do is to get together and have a drink or two and then get out your musical scores and start going through things. And there have been a number of impromptu performances of PDQ Bach things late at night, gathered around the piano after a glass of wine or two.
Well, if I'm at Sunday night's concert, you know I'm going to be shouting out for encore PDQ Bach.
the unfortunate thing is I don't think PDQ Bach wrote anything for countertenor and theorbo.
Oh, rats.
So, you know, if I find one in the next 2 days, it may be possible, but I wouldn't hold your hopes up.
Well, that was an easy out.
Yeah, well, I try. we are, however, doing something very unusual on Sunday, and we're premiering a new work, which is less unusual for countertenor than it was, but it's certainly unusual for somebody who plays lute or for theorbo. And it's actually a piece by Chet Allwes, who's the director of Bach, and a wonderful composer in and of its own right. And he's actually written us a commissioned piece that we'll be premiering on Sunday that we're very excited about. The text is by George Herbert, one of the great English poets, and it's a text that was actually set by Henry Purcell. I don't know that anyone else has set it other than Henry Purcell and Chet. It's a wonderful text with sick and famished eyes, and it's one of these. It's a lot like John Donne poetry. It's incredibly religious, and in a way that's more personal than you would ever expect to hear from a churchy piece written in the 1700s. It's a very wonderful piece, and we're very excited to get to do this. Jeff's done a lot of contemporary premieres of pieces. But I don't know that he's done one that was actually written for him or for theorbo in modern times. It just doesn't happen very often.
Well, audiences can look forward to hearing that and all the Baroque music on your recital Sunday night. It's Jay Carter, my guest here on Live and Local, performing with lutenist, he's countertenor, performing with lutenist Jeffrey Noonan. Sunday night at 7:30 at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine. It's on South Wright Street in Champaign. It is not the St. John's Chapel, the Catholic Chapel, on the other corner, but the Episcopal Chapel. And for more information, you can go to baroqueartists.org. Jay, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin. It was a pleasure.
And I'm sorry we ran out of time to actually hear more of Jay Carter's voice. You can remedy that by going to his website, jcartersings.com, and, of course, go hear him on Sunday night. This is Illinois Public Media, WYLFM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana with translators.